You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day in Davis. Don, do I get to say that forever now if it's a rain stop for the season?
Well, yes, the rainfall incidence drops rapidly as we get into April. We only had an inch or two of rain in March here locally. We are going into some beautiful sunny weather. But what was that temperature this morning that I forwarded over to you?
You told me it was 37. I was shocked.
37 degrees. Let's see. Let's back up here. We're supposed to do this. We are recording this on April 2nd, 2025 for broadcast on April 3, 2025. And as I look right now at the National Weather Service, the temperature at the, in this instance, the Sacramento Executive Airport is 50 degrees. I had a funny conversation with a guy. He was, what's that temperature you're looking for tomatoes? I said, well, 50 is like the bare minimum for what we want. Well, it's like 52 today. I said, no, minimum, not maximum.
You said it was 37 yesterday, and I think that was an April Fool's joke.
It was 37 degrees this morning, April 2nd here, and I did see a little sparkle of frost out in my meadow. Bear in mind that I'm out in the country, so you know I'm open to the sky, and I'll see frost on days that people in town would not. And this was not a significant frost, but 37 degrees. I really don't even like having tomato plants in my garden center if it's below 45, because they start to turn kind of purplish and they're being affected by the low temperature. So yesterday evening, 5:10, 5:15, getting ready to close up, we looked at the forecast. We looked at the fact that there were a bunch of tomato plant flats out there because people want them. And we moved them all into our pop-up greenhouses to give them a little more heat overnight. And it's frustrating to have to do that at this time of year, but people are buying tomato plants and they're gathering their collection of varieties or walking in with lists of what they want. We get that. That's very cool. We're putting them in the greenhouse to keep them warmer. 37 degrees, I definitely wouldn't put them out in the ground. What's the temperature tonight? Well, 38 is what they're forecasting for tonight. Distinct. So the flats go back in tonight, and I got about 60 flats of tomatoes coming in this week. Tonight will be 38. Thursday, definite warming trend, thank goodness. Thursday, 66. Thursday night, 41. I would like to see that a little higher. Friday, 71 and sunny. Friday night, 44, mostly clear. Saturday, 74 degrees and sunny. Boy, is that going to be spectacular. Saturday night, 44 degrees, mostly clear. Sunday, 73 degrees and mostly sunny. And a warming trend for next week. We know that. Now, it's funny if you look at the National Weather Service and then Weather Underground and then go over to Zentusky, that cool site with all the graphics where you can move your cursor around and see what the temperature is going to be even 10 days out. The Weather Service is saying by mid next week, we will be in the mid 70s. So to answer the eternal question.
Hey, Don, is it time to plant tomatoes yet?
Okay. For those of you that want to do early tomatoes, look for varieties that are reasonably consistent, that are not susceptible to blossom end rot, and keep your expectations low and be prepared to cover them up a little bit. That might be my best answer. Varieties that I'd suggest for early planting, well, of course, Early Girl. And now there's three iterations of Early Girl out there in stores. Early Girl Plus, which has more disease resistance bred into it, and Bush Early Girl, which is a more compact version. And of course, have now tested New Girl, and it's just as good as Early Girl, if not better, in terms of total production. Does not seem to be real susceptible to blossom end rot. And that right there is one of the biggest drawbacks to early planting, is that the fruit that sets early on many varieties gets that squishy thing on the bottom of the fruit where it spoils as it's ripening, blossom end rot. And we know that it appears to be almost entirely related to soil moisture and soil temperature. So when you plant early, the fruit that sets early has a high propensity for blossom end rot. If you're planting early, probably stay away from bigger fruited types. And stay away from Roma. It's absolutely the canary in the coal mine when it comes to blossom end rot. It gets it no matter what. So plant it later if that's fine, but you're not going to gain anything by early planting of that one. What's a good one? 4th of July is another one. The local master gardener has been recommending that for years. I finally grew it about 10 years ago. It's phenomenal. It's about a 3 or 4 ounce fruit, very bright red. The name 4th of July tells you it will be ripe by the 4th of July. It always is. And I've never had blossom end rot problems on it. So look around for that one. And the one bigger fruited one that you could try was bred and introduced for the purpose of early planting, Big Beef, a All-America selection back in the 1990s. Big fruit. I've had good years with Big Beef and not such great years with Big Beef. It's temperature sensitive at the upper end of the range, but it will set and hold surprisingly large fruit early in the season. So that's just, that'll be this week's tomato segment. Look for varieties like that. 4th of July, early girl, new girl. Don't plant Roma. Don't plant really big ones. Oh, if you really want a big one, do Big Beef. There you go. That's the tomato talk for this week.
I want to tell you about that here at KDRT, we've gotten some new shows recently. And this one, we talked about it before, but it hadn't started yet. It's going now. Started April 1st, Tuesday evenings at 5:30. It's called Taste, Talk, and Whine, W-H-I-N-E, Whine.
Okay.
Yes. And with hosts Nicole Salengo-Lee and Tree Kilpatrick.
Yep.
And they have a weekly discussion on winemaking, wine tasting, and general enjoyment. So you can listen to them Tuesday at 5:30 and then keep listening, and Tree will be on with his Root, Shoots, and Leaves at 6. DMA, which is the parent organization for KDRT, mm-hmm. does every spring, it does an appeal letter. It sends out letters to people who have expressed interest and, you know, ask them if they'll donate. Well, in order to send out all those letters, we have a mailing party where you can go stuff MLOs, stick in. It's wonderful. If you would like to volunteer, feel free. It's April 16th, and it's their annual appeal mailing party. Contact DMA if you are interested.
DMA stands for Davis Media Access.
Yes, and info@kdrt.org is always your best place to write about anything about the station.
April 12th, which is a week from Saturday, is Picnic Day, which overwhelms the city of Davis as thousands and thousands of people come here and come downtown and do all kinds of stuff. Campus, just want to let you know, it's a nice, safe place to take your family. No alcohol is allowed on campus. And there are events all over the place. And I just want to go ahead and refer you to the link of events, because I was going to scroll through and find ones about plants. And there's 8 pages of activities on Picnic Day. So you just go to, this is easy, picnicday.ucdavis.edu. picnicday.ucdavis.edu. Click on the events, and I love the fact that the first two are Picnic Day Fashion Show and Slime Time. Those are not at the same place. Slime Time, I'm sure, is a family-friendly activity. You can get water analysis for metals done. You can go to a presentation on the science of chocolate. You can go to a program about coffee. There's the new Coffee Institute. Taste different types of coffee at the brand new UC Davis Coffee Center, the nation's first academic center devoted to coffee science. And that's at the Coffee Center, which is at Poudre Creek Lodge Drive, and so forth. So I'm not even going to go through all these. You can find pages of them. There's something for everybody, including the ever-popular Dachshund races. And head over to the Plant and Environmental Sciences Courtyard area. The UC Master Gardeners of Yolo County will be there from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. to answer your questions. So there's people there to talk about gardening. Almost every department does something for Picnic Day. When I was in the botany department, we moved a whole bunch of plants from the greenhouses over to the botany building so people could see tropical plants. Just walking around. My parents would have a great time coming up for Picnic Day because you can just walk around and find stuff. And as I say, on campus is family friendly. Okay, what else do we have to talk about?
Well, we have a spring plant sale coming up the following week, April 19th. And that's the Yolo Master Gardeners. They have something going on at Winter's Community Library Teaching Garden, which is someplace I didn't know existed, but Don knew about it. And the address is 708 Railroad Avenue in Winter's.
Okay, well, we got lots of questions. It must be spring. People are in the gardening mood. They're taking out their lawns and putting in flowers. They're getting ready for vegetable season and flower season. Look at the mailbag.
One more announcement
Okay.
is that the Thursday evening Zoom presentations
Oh,
by
yeah.
the Master Gardener, there's going to be one on April 10th about IPM. That's what, Don? IPM.
Integrated pest management.
And it's going to be fun. So
Pest
contact
management is going to be fun.
the talk's going to be fun.
Okay.
The
All right.
talk's
So let's have a
anyway,
not fun.
lots of stuff.
Let's have a not fun talk about pest management. I am having to answer this question every single day. So I'm going to go ahead and put this out there. We've talked about it briefly before, but effective January 1, 2025, garden centers, hardware stores can no longer sell systemic insecticides to homeowners. You cannot buy, possess, or use them. This includes the neonicotinoid products that have been used for management of aphids on Chinese hackberry trees and crepe myrtles, and that are also widely used to control aphids on roses. You cannot buy, possess, or use these. There is not a replacement product available that you apply in that manner that goes up into the plant and makes it kill the aphids. So we do not have control measures for those pests on those plants. Pest control services and appropriately licensed tree services can legally apply these for you. We contacted a local pest control company that does termite and ant spraying for residential properties, and they verified that they offer this service and noted that most others of their type do as well. Any company you're already working with for termite or ant control around your house can legally apply this material to your tree or your roses if you wish to have them do that. When this gets posted in places like Nextdoor, people jump in and talk about ladybugs. Releasing ladybugs will not provide adequate control of the aphids on Chinese hackberries and crepe myrtles. What?
There's not enough ladybugs to get
This
an
is
entire tree
actually
covered.
the point I have made. Walk up to those trees and look at them. There's already ladybugs present. They're already there. These pests on crepe myrtle, the aphid on crepe myrtles has been here for 15 years. The pest on Chinese hackberry has been here for 20. They've settled in. The population has reached an equilibrium with respect to beneficial insects in the area, ladybugs, lacewings, leatherwing beetles, other things that feed on aphids. There are loads of them present on trees that are untreated. You'll find them. The question is, this is a nuisance pest. Nuisance pest meaning that the trees drip sticky stuff on the ground underneath the tree, making your yard essentially unusable right under the tree because of the daily continued deposition of this honeydew secretion that's coming from them. They're there. The ladybugs are already present. If that is adequate control as far as you're concerned, fine, because a nuisance pest is simply that. It's just a nuisance. It's just saying, we're just saying the sticky drip is tolerable or not tolerable. But releasing them won't make any difference. They're already present in the population that is going to be sustained by that tree's population of aphids. The growth rate of those aphids is exponential. The growth rate in population, growth rate of the ladybugs and others is linear. So while they're present, they're not giving, for most people's feelings, adequate control to reduce the nuisance factor. Aphids on roses can be managed surprisingly easily. You can just blast them off with water. You can use sprays of insecticidal soap. You can use light oils. There's a bunch of products out there that are very low toxicity to people, at least with respect to aphids on your roses. But one, they're just killing the aphids you're spraying them on. Those right there at that moment. You're not doing anything that's going to continue to kill them, so you just have to keep spraying. Second, be aware that soap and oil sprays can burn the foliage and damage the blossoms of roses when we get warm temperatures. And so if we warm up suddenly, so we might be doing next week, for example, and you go out and spray in the morning with a light oil like neem oil, and then it warms up into the mid to upper 80s. You can burn the leaves. You can burn the petals of the roses that you're presumably trying to protect. Blasting them with water is safe at any time of day and any season. So very commonly when I say rinse them off with water, I get, well, don't do that in the late afternoon. It might, you know, might cause this, that, or the other problem. In our climate, that's, don't worry about it. Just rinse them off vigorously and it can be quite effective. But the key thing here is you can't buy these. There's no alternative. So you're going to have to turn to other pest control methods unless you have a tree and you're willing to pay a tree service or a pest control company to come in and apply that product. And yes, it is basically the same product you were applying before. Probably going to cost more to have them do it, but that's what's going to have to happen if you want them to control that product on your trees. This is why crepe myrtle sales are tanking in Northern California. I used to sell 3 to 5 crepe myrtles every weekend all summer long. If I sold 10 total last summer, I'd be surprised, because I want people to know when they're buying a tree. I'll tell them, if you're about to buy a tree and you're talking about a crepe myrtle for your patio, I say, I would not put this over your patio. It's going to get the crepe myrtle aphid. It's going to cause a sticky drip out in your lawn, over a flower border. Fine. It's not really that big an issue. Just minor nuisance out there, but over a hardscape surface, you don't want to use it. But if you have that, rinsing off a crepe myrtle isn't the most practical thing to do. Spraying it with any kind of insecticide is not the most practical thing to do. So at this point, what I'm saying is you pretty much have to tolerate it or pay a company to come in and treat it with what you were using. I don't like people using imidacloprid on flowering trees. I don't like them using it on flowering plants like roses. From when these first came on the market, I went back and found an old radio show we did where we were talking about this 15 years ago when these products first came on, and someone asked, is this really okay to use? No, neonicotinoids on plants that are flowering, it says right on the label, you shouldn't do it. But there they are selling them for roses. To me, that has been a problem. But unfortunately, your only tool that was completely effective has now gone away. So try this if you have aphids on your roses. Try doing nothing. See what happens. Watch the population. Monitor it. It will increase for 10 to 14 days, and then it'll plateau. And you'll notice that the aphids are typically disappearing, either because of higher temperature range for their reproductive cycle, it takes them out of their reproductive cycle, or that linear increase in beneficials has come along and catching up with them, or some combination of those two things. Typically, aphids are about a 4 to 6 week problem in the spring, and then they tend to go away on their own on plants like roses. You can clean up a plant where you're going to cut some blossoms by washing them off, and then cut those, rinse them off, take them into the house if that bothers you. But typically, if you have a healthy yard with grasses and other flowers and shrubs nearby that you're not pruning super hard, you've got beneficial insects already present, ready to move in when the aphid populations increase. And on your rose bushes, I think you'll find if you back off from the tendency to rush out and buy a pesticide as the population is increasing, watch it plateau, watch for the parasitized ones that are bloated and already indicating the presence of parasitic wasps. Go out there and see if those ladybugs and especially the leatherwing beetles and the lacewings are present. That's what happens on my roses, is the cavalry comes in and takes care of the problem. So if you can be patient, you'll find most of these things within 2 to 4 weeks of your first noticing them tend to go away on their own. On the trees, no, that Asian woolly hackberry aphid is going to continue to increase all summer. So you'll have to decide whether you can tolerate that sticky drip. Under crepe myrtles, it'll be the same issue. But on a rose bush, I don't think you need these systemic insecticides. End rant.
Well, we have a message. This is from Beth, who says, my mom and I love listening to your show. Mm-hmm. I live in Portland, Oregon, and my mom and dad live in Granite Bay, California. Is now a good time to put 16-16-16 fertilizer in both our gardens? Here in Portland, my 30-year-old rhododendrons have big fat buds on them. I can't wait for them to open up. Your show brings us such joy. And I should say this is an older email, so those roadies have probably already burst into bloom.
Could be.
But anyway, Don, tell me about this 16-16-16 fertilizer.
Well, triple 16 fertilizer is one of the so-called balanced fertilizer products that's been on the market for a long time. 10-10-10, 10-10-5, 5-10-10, 16-16-16, 16-12-12. Those ratios don't have any relationship to how plants use the nutrients involved. Those three numbers are NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, in that order. Every fertilizer product you buy must be labeled with the guaranteed analysis of that presence. And if they say 16, 16, 16, they're guaranteeing it's at least 16% nitrogen, at least 16% phosphorus, at least 16% potassium. I've looked at lots of soil tests. You know, it's often recommended that you send your soil out to a lab and have it sent back to tell you what nutrients you need. In our area, I've never seen a deficiency indicated for phosphorus. In fact, invariably, it shows phosphorus, which is the middle number, at the highest level that their bar chart will go to. It doesn't say excessive, but it's certainly sufficient. And in some cases, it could be excessive if depending on how you define that with phosphorus. So you generally don't need it. And potassium is generally not deficient either. That's much less of a concern to me. The presence of all that phosphorus can gradually suppress soil mycorrhiza. So unless you've had a soil test done, particularly up in Oregon, I seriously doubt if this is the case in Granite Bay, but if you're up in Oregon and you've had a soil test done that indicates you need phosphorus, go ahead and use the triple 16. Otherwise, my preference these days is to steer people towards fertilizers that are predominantly nitrogen. And I'm not real concerned about the third number, the potassium number, because that's really what plants typically need. A soil test is not even going to tell you that because it's very hard for them to test for nitrogen. I did have a customer come in who said her soil test had shown that she needed nitrogen and they gave her a specific amount to use. And I said, that's fine. The soil test may or may not have been even remotely accurate because nitrogen can change formulation, even volatilize and drift away before the package of your soil that you've sent to them gets tested. It's very hard to accurately test for nitrogen except literally on site with agricultural soil test package kits. Don't even worry about it. Nitrogen is always beneficial for flowers, always beneficial for vegetables, may or may not be necessary for your woody plants. If you have 30-year-old rhododendrons that are doing great, growing adequately and blooming well, you probably don't need to feed them at all. Okay? It wouldn't necessarily hurt. And if you haven't been growing as well or your local garden center thinks it's necessary, nothing wrong with giving them nitrogen. But phosphorus is one of those funny ones. If you've listened to the show for a long time, you know that I tend to be pushing against people using it now. Big part of that is that I used to think applying high phosphorus was harmless. You know, we use the dictum from Dr. Linda Chalker Scott. If you're asking about a product or a practice, is it necessary? Is it harmful? If it's necessary, do it. If it's harmful, don't. If it's neither of those, it's your money. Do what you want. Okay. So nurseries aren't going to talk you out of high phosphorus fertilizers. You're not going to go into a garden center and be told, don't buy this. They're not going to do that. But in general, phosphorus is not necessary. Is it harmful? It can be. If you incorporate it in large amounts and get it around the root zone, it can suppress the growth of soil mycorrhiza. Putting it on the surface may or may not be harmful, but I don't think that's absolutely necessary. So I would suggest you look at your local garden center up there. They probably have one that's labeled for camellias, rhododendrons, things like that. Up in the Pacific Northwest, I know that your average nursery is going to have products specifically for rhododendrons. I would like to see the first number higher than the other two. That's my bottom line. There's going to be all kinds of different proportions out there you might find, and they'll have different reasons for those different proportions, but you don't typically need that high phosphorus content. And that definitely goes for the family member in Granite Bay, where you're almost certainly not dealing with a phosphorus deficiency. It's worth having a soil test done every now and then, especially if you're moved into a new place and you don't know the soils that well and you're going to plant a vegetable garden. Sure, get a soil test done. And if you get one that shows a deficiency of phosphorus or potassium, send it to us. I'd love to look at it. DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
So there is another problem with over-fertilizing, and that is that it can run off and go into the streams and the rivers and the lakes and the oceans, and that's not good for fish.
Right, and phosphorus is well known for that. The one thing about phosphates is that when they go onto soil, they're immediately adsorbed, is a soil science term, which means that phosphate groups are held pretty tightly by soil particles. In fact, it's probably not even getting to the roots when you scatter triple 16 around a plant. When you throw a triple 16 granular fertilizer under your shrub and then you water it in or it rains, the nitrogen part immediately dissolves and goes into the soil. The different forms of nitrogen differ as to what happens then. Some of them are continue to go through because they're very soluble and not readily adsorbed. Some of them stay around and do what they're supposed to do. Phosphorus is grabbed onto by mulch, by bark, by the top layer of soil. And my guess is those soil tests are probably not terribly accurate because it's very hard to figure out whether it's been distributed into the root zone. The only way to get phosphorus into a plant, and I only know this, I have an advantage. My garden center is in a town with a highly educated customer base. I have customers who know way more about phosphorus implants than I do. And one of our very first customers when we opened was an older gentleman who had spent his entire career on phosphorus uptake in fruit trees. And he told me firmly, a soil test for phosphorus is likely not accurate for orchard growers and farmers. You need to do leaf tissue analysis to determine whether the plant is actually deficient in phosphorus, because they can throw all the phosphorus on the ground they want to, and it never goes past the top inch of soil because it's adsorbed that tightly by the soil colloids and the other, and organic mulches in particular will hold on to it. As Lois alludes, it can become a waste issue, a pollution issue, and that happens primarily when there's enough rain to carry soil away. So the good news is phosphorus itself doesn't usually dissolve into rainwater and then wash into the storm drain. The bad news is it does go with the silt. And so if you get enough rainfall or water to run off, you may be carrying it into the storm drain system. It's just not necessary. And in some cases, it can be detrimental. And I just want to get people away from the notion that phosphorus is something you need to apply. In most cases, it isn't. And potassium is almost rarely deficient. So look for a higher nitrogen number. Look for something generally formulated for your rhododendrons and your Pacific Northwest acid-loving, shrubby, woody plants. And see if you can get something that's just not so high in phosphorus. And same thing goes for Granite Bay. Mainly plants need nitrogen. They don't typically need the other macronutrients unless you're showing an indication of that deficiency. You may have trace element deficiencies that cause yellowing leaves, interveinal chlorosis, smaller leaves. Those are things that will tend to be rather local. In the Davis area, for example, I see zinc deficiency at times. We see iron and magnesium deficiency at times, purportedly because of the pH of our water and the pH of our soil. Those are things you can try to correct, although it can be challenging. But that's the kind of thing you would need to find out locally. I don't know what trace elements you might be deficient in the Oregon area. And in Granite Bay, my guess is you're closer to our situation. So don't try and play around too much with soil chemistry. Don't worry too much about minor yellowing of leaves, but sometimes it can indicate a micronutrient deficiency. You may want to try and correct that. Nitrogen is the main thing you're after, whether you use an organic source or a conventional source. That'll just determine how fast it'll react and how often you would need to do it. So make your choices that way. But read that guaranteed analysis and let's steer away from the high phosphorus content.
Beth, I have a request of you. Please take some pictures of your rhododendrons and azaleas and whatever else you got going up there.
Yeah.
Take some nice flower photos and send them to us. We love to see what people are doing. And the email address is?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com. And I always like to tell the story of a family friend up in Seattle who I went to visit. We showed up there and they had beautiful gardens. Gardens there, by the way, are quite a slope, and there's some interesting soils, and you got big trees and all that kind of stuff. They had more rhododendrons than I can even imagine because we can't grow them here. And I said, how do you get so much bloom in here all the time? And she said, it's really simple. If I walk out here and there's not a rhododendron blooming, I go to the garden center and I buy one that's blooming.
So now let's get on to the central part of our show today.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, a customer wrote in and I was looking at the picture, but let me read this. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing.
Through this in parts. Yeah, let's take it in segments. Okay.
So I'm removing my front lawn. This is Mimi, who is writing and says, there are some questions. There is a program from Santa Clara Valley Water to encourage residents to convert lawns to low water use landscapes. There is a tremendous plant list provided by Santa Clara Valley Water that qualifies as low water in this program. I sent in my proposed plant list. They must cover 50% of the square feet. And I got approval to proceed. I have 3 months to get it done.
Yeah.
That's 180 days is allowed. There's a couple extensions there. So my front lawn conversion. I'm going to convert to mostly herbs and perennial garden, peppered with some animals, with some rocks and boulders, a gardener's path, etc. Mow the lawn as close to the ground as possible, scalp it. Install sprinkler caps, that is to caps to close off the sprinklers that she has. She has Rainbird sprinklers.
Mm-hmm.
Get arborist wood chips and lay down them.
Yep.
Oh my. As suggested by Linda Chalker Scott from gardenprofessor.com, I lay down at about 8 inches thick.
Yeah.
To maintain that depth to suppress the turf and the persistent weeds. Wait a couple of weeks for turf to decompose. After 2 to 4 weeks, pull apart the mulch and check how things are doing underneath. Then buy your plants and then plant. So,
yeah.
Before I jump head first into the project, I would like your advice. Here are my questions.
Mm-hmm.
Any gotchas in the plan above and any suggestions on anything she's doing wrong with that 5-step thing?
No, this is great. It's so much simpler than the lasagna method and a lot of these things that I see out there where people are covering their yards with cardboard and other very unattractive things. 8 inches of arborist wood chips will do it. I mean, Dr. Chakra Scott knows what she's talking about. She has extensive publications on this. You can go to the Garden Professor's blog, separate from their Facebook page if you want to, and read their articles on this. The advantage of arborist wood chips is this isn't bark and it isn't compost. It's stuff ground of trees that have been cut down. So it's still wet. It's still got moisture in it. It still more or less was alive at the time it was cut down. Unlike bark, which is hydrophobic, arborist wood chips are moist. And so if you put them on your soil, you've cut your lawn very short and you're dumping these on and there's moisture, you might even want to water a little bit to settle things in. She can show you and we can verify that organisms immediately move up into them. Because they're not dry, they're moist, so they can live in them. So you get fungus and bacteria invading the chips and beginning to break them down, which will enrich the soil. You get worms going up and down and up and down, creating macro pores. And so it's a way to improve the soil while smothering out anything. Now, Dr. Chakra Scott is up in Washington, where your major weeds are woody plants, and has shown how you can use this even with things like berries and, you know, plants that you would think would be very hard to control. The key is, most important principle in killing plants is that they can't live without photosynthesis. Most. There's a tiny handful of exceptions. They're fascinating. But most plants cannot live without photosynthesis. If they push through the chips, cut them off. Bury them again. Whatever. Just keep them from photosynthesizing. In theory, anything will die if you keep it from photosynthesizing. So 8 inches is not unreasonable. And I know it sounds like a lot. Lois can tell you, what it's like to get a giant pile of arborist wood chips and move them around. You're going, really? A foot of this stuff is okay? Yeah, it's fine. It doesn't hurt anything. And pile some extra up over in the corner so that, you know, as that Bermuda grass pushes back through, or the nutsedge or the morning glory, chop it off, bury it again. Just put another couple of shovels full on top of it. So that's great. The only thing I would throw in here, and I have this opportunity many times at the start of these projects, you don't need to get rid of your sprinkler system. You may very well use that sprinkler system in the future. It's perfectly okay to water new low water plants with a spray type sprinkler system. You just use it very, very differently than you were using it before. And it's even fine if it's laid out and designed for a turf area. We can talk about this as you get going further into this project, but sprinklers are a perfectly acceptable way to water plants. You're just going to have multiple start times on the same day to make sure you're putting enough water on those plants. And you're going to make sure they continue to give coverage as plants grow and perhaps block them. Sure, drip is more efficient. Drip is something you can convert to over time, and you may be deciding to do that. But there's no reason you can't just continue to use your existing sprinklers just very, very differently than you were using them before.
One of the things that I want to remind people of, if they heard the saga of Lois and the wood chips,
mm-hmm.
is when you put that 8 inches of wood chips on, if you have an edge where there's your sidewalks,
yes.
and then there's a cliff of eight yes. inches of wood chips,
yeah.
it's going to fall over
yep.
onto your side. So before you have the people put the wood chips on, I would recommend that you go next to your sidewalk and you dig out at a slant
mm-hmm.
down a ways so that when the wood chips are laid out, they can be at the level of the sidewalk and still be several inches deep on the dirt.
Yeah, another alternative, and I've had people show me two different options where they have that problem. You don't want the stuff slumping out on the sidewalk. Is you can go out and get some of these composite materials that are used as edging and just go ahead and put a 4-inch edge of Trex or some of these other materials like that, better than bender board. They're just longer lasting so that it'll hold back the stuff while you're waiting for it to kill the weeds below. And you may well take that out later. One person went and got concrete blocks, 8x8x16 concrete blocks. They had another use for them later. So they just put an edge of those along the sidewalk on their property. Mm. They did dig out a little bit so they'd be reasonably stable. They put that in so it looked like a retaining wall, basically. And then they filled in with the arborist wood chips, and they came right up to the blocks. Once they knew that the grass was dead and they were ready to, or their plan was, I don't know whether they actually followed up on this, once they knew that it was dead, they were going to pull those blocks out, take them to the backyard for their vegetable garden and to make raised planters out of them, and just rake back the chips so that they weren't going to sprawl out onto the sidewalk. But it enabled them to have a barrier for the time being, for the more like 6 to 8 weeks that it takes to completely kill out the grass that's there. I would want to know, if you came in to talk to me about this, what kind of grass are you killing? Because if it's Bermuda grass, if you have Bermuda grass in there and we're in the 1st of April, it's just coming out of dormancy now, and 2 to 4 weeks isn't going to kill it. You need to be aware of that. It is going to start vigorously growing and will try to get through the wood chips and try to get, especially on the edge of the wood chips. Be prepared for that. It's not the end of the world. It digs out surprisingly easily when it's just on the edge. It's usually very shallowly rooted at that point. If it does push through the chips, which it surprisingly can do, even with 8-inch layer there, again, chop and bury, chop and bury. Just keep doing that. But do be prepared for the fact that perennial weeds such as Bermuda grass, nutsedge, and morning glory or bindweed can just push right through even several inches of arborist wood chips until you've basically prevented them from being able to reestablish week after week, chop, bury as needed. You can still plant. You don't have to wait till that's all dead to plant. You just have to be aware that there's a good possibility that certain of these difficult to control weeds will come back on you.
So your second question here, I'm glad you asked that, because when I looked at your pictures, the first thing I said was, ooh, they have a lawn shared with their neighbor, and now she's going to take that lawn out and plant all this other stuff in, and there's not going to be any place for the neighbor to run the lawnmower in order to keep their lawn mowed. Yep. And so I was thinking immediately, okay, dig a trench and put down a concrete
something,
stripe. Yep. Curb, whatever you want to call it. And I would actually make it fairly wide, 12-inch wide or something, so that they can get their lawnmower on easily and cut their lawn. Yep. And your plants aren't slopping over onto their lawn, so they're not cutting your plants while you're... So anyway, but her question, she asked this. She said, what would you recommend as the simplest or easiest lawn dividers? My neighbors and I have always shared the lawn with no dividers since the kids loved running around when they were growing up. I'm thinking of a natural edge with landscape rocks, herbs, and shrubs. I like to make sure that we should have some sort of edging to prevent my plants from spilling over and messing up their lawn, which they plan to continue to maintain.
Yeah.
And so I would say, whatever you do on the edge, make it flat.
Yeah, make a
mower. It's not going to want lumps.
I would just put in kind of a path, actually, and rocks would be fine. Flagstone would be fine. Blocks would be fine. And then make sure and have some through your new garden area, too, because people are going to want to walk through there and look at the salvias and the lavenders and the flowering colchicums and the nepetas. And did you get all those written down? All these cool plants that are going to bloom there. And if you like your neighbors and this has been sort of a shared area, there's two things to keep in mind. One, yes, they'll need to get their mowers and then walk through there, and your mailman will probably walk through there. Plan for it. Plan for paths. Don't get mad at people for doing what is their natural tendency to take the shortest route. Put step stones in there. I'm always reminded of how the Army would build military bases. They'd put the buildings in, they'd wait till the paths developed, then they'd pave them. I was told that years ago by someone who worked for the Army Corps of Engineers. You put the paths where people actually use them rather than trying to force people to follow geometric patterns, which people just don't naturally do. So that'd be the first thing. Plan for traffic through your new garden, because it's going to really be attractive, and a place that your neighbors can go along and mow carefully. Also, they're going to keep watering a lawn. This is one of these shared, properties where they're together, but they have separate irrigation systems. So their watering of their lawn is going to affect the plants 2 to 3 feet into your side. So if you're doing natives, for example, or low water plants, make sure that the ones that go along there can tolerate watering that you don't control. That could be as simple as a chorus or some sedges or certain grasses that would complement their turf, lower grasses, for example, some of the fescues that make really attractive landscape plants. So just make sure that you just work with the fact that their irrigation water by capillary action is going to spread onto your side. You don't control that. It might even overshoot onto your side. So you don't plant ceanothus, manzanita, lavender, rosemary, where that's going to happen, because you'll be in, you know, they'll be in prone to crown rot or root rot in that situation. But there's plenty of plants that can take that, including irises and a whole lot of really cool flowering plants. That zone next to your neighbor should be planted carefully, choosing the plants for their ability to tolerate irrigation that you can't control.
Her third question is, I am in zone 9B. My front lawn is south facing. Even though there is a giant Zelkova tree located at the front of the house, it's hot in the summer. Mm-hmm. Does the plant list attached make sense in terms of heat tolerance and seasonal coverage and color? For example, I'm not sure if chamomile would survive, so I put it nearer to the tree. Because there are so many species within each genus, sage, lavender, etc., I can mix and match. What are some of the different species you would recommend there? I can still change it during the 3 months I'm planting and resubmit it as to what I finally plant due to lack of availability or other reasons that could arise.
Your question.
And third, I'm planning to just cap the sprinkler heads, hand water. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, we addressed that one. Hand watering is great. We can come back to that in a moment. Now, I have an employee who has chamomile that he planted in his vegetable garden. So we sell it all the time, year round. It's not super heat tolerant, but spring and fall chamomile does great here. He will tell you, it reseeds very readily. He has, at least 100 seedlings all around his vegetable garden. He is finding chamomile annoying in that regard, actually. So in terms of it being part of your garden, it's now there's two different chamomile plants. One is a ground cover that lasts 1 to 2 years and rots out. The other is this one that's used for tea, which is the one he planted. It's a great plant. Beneficials love the flowers. It's a ferny looking foliage. It's really a very pretty plant, but I don't have any concern about it establishing well in your landscape. It'll probably reseed happily right into 8 inches of arborist wood chips without any difficulty. But if you like that look, Achillea or yarrows are a very good choice. And those are a permanent perennial plant that is easy to grow and basically grows and blooms almost anywhere in California. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of varieties of Achillea, A-C-H-I-L-L-E-A. There's native forms, there's non-native forms, there's garden hybrids, there's all kinds of them. And so if you like the ferny look of the chamomile, and you're just mostly attracted to that appearance and the cool little clusters of flowers, yarrow or Achillea will do much the same thing. Nothing wrong with planting chamomile. Just be aware that each plant functions as an annual. It's a plant that's going to naturalize in your landscape wherever it chooses, apparently. I have not had this experience, but he certainly has. So anyone who's buying chamomile gets a little bit of a warning now when they're buying the kind that's used for tea. The ground cover kind, honestly, I've got to say this, these ground covers like thyme and chamomile, the one that doesn't flower, and some of the others, they're not long-lived. And I have to go through this with people who have been talking to landscape architects or designers who are going, replace your lawn with creeping thyme. Sure, just be prepared to replace it with something else in 3 years, because I have almost never seen it established longer than 2 to 3 years and not develop problems. But if you want something that's going to fill in around other plants, and you have some here, and then you have yarrow over there, and then you have snow and summer over there, mix and match these kinds of ground covers. I guess that's the only advice I would give on that particular plant. Salvias is a huge group. And there's lots of salvias that will take there's a salvia for every need. Okay. If you want a salvia for the shade, the one that's called hummingbird sage bewilders me because they all attract hummingbirds, but this one is particularly called hummingbird sage. Salvia spathacea. I can't get it. Most retailers can't get it, but the Arboretum sale at UC Davis, they typically do have at least a few. So that's one to watch for. It's an Arboretum all-star. Most of the herbaceous salvias can take some shade. Our California native salvias, which are blooming right now, mine are in full bloom and they're quite spectacular. Cleveland sage, Dara's choice is a particularly nice one. Salvia sonamensis, the Sonoma sage. These are shrubby salvias, woody plants that spread several feet. My Cleveland sage, I finally took a picture of it. It's 20 feet across after 25 years. It has fallen out and rooted all the way down a long border. So it can cover quite a territory, or you can cut it back hard if you want to. But our native salvias can take a fair bit of shade or full sun, watering or not. They're very tough plants and nothing grows through them. I have no weeds where I have our native salvias. They're one of the most effective woody plants for suppressing the growth of annual weeds, especially that I have ever found. And I put rosemary in that category as well. It's now considered a salvia. So for the sunnier sections, they're sure to do well. For the shaded sections, they'll very likely do well. And there's even some that can tolerate more shade. But these are big plants. I want people who buy our native salvias to know they're large plants. But there are salvias from the American Southwest, the Greggii, the microphylla types, which can be kept 2 to 4 feet with no problem. And there's a whole lot of herbaceous salvias, Salvia farinacea, Nemorosa, some of the others, which die completely to the ground in the winter. They're hardy way up into northern climates, and they're herbaceous perennials. And so they come up and bloom with these spikes of flowers. And then those are done, and you cut them to the ground, and they're basically a ground level foliage through the winter, and then they come back year after year. So that whole genus is going to be a really good one to work with. And the woody ones are the more drought tolerant, but you can stick in some of the herbaceous ones for fun and for color, and they can take sun or shade in general. And most of them can tolerate watering or not. So that's an important consideration for some of these areas where you may not have complete control over the irrigation. The woody ones are extremely drought tolerant. And if you do a combination of California native sages and Southwestern sages, you'll have blooms basically year around. The native ones mostly in the spring, the Southwestern ones starting, well, now, but midsummer to fall. They're often called autumn sage. And this year, they bloomed right through the winter. I have a picture of Hot Lips Salvia, one of the most popular of the group, 3x3 plant out at a retirement community in full bloom in January. Looked absolutely spectacular. And the hummingbirds are very appreciative of that because there's not that much else blooming in their category at that time of year. So that's a genus I would definitely focus on and have fun with lavenders and teucriums and nepetas and some of the others that are closely related. But that's going to be a good group for you in general.
Don, are you looking at her chart? Because she has some interesting things on it. I think I'll read it so the listeners can hear. Feverfew.
Mm-hmm. That's a cool plant. That's a flower. I've grown it. It blooms all the time. Interesting fact, it actually repels bees.
It's kind of short, though.
It's easy to grow. It's a cool flowering herbaceous perennial for this situation. Sure.
And then she has the Spiraxis, which are bulbs. Oh, yeah. And those would be wonderful, but they only bloom once a year.
They bloom heavily. They're finishing up. They reseed and multiply like crazy. I know people who have planted Spiraxis who have almost come to regret it. It's one of those corms, South African corm. So those of you listening in colder climates, it's not going to work for you. But here in USDA Zones 9 and certainly in Zone 10, it can multiply to the point of it could easily naturalize in California with no problem. A lot of South African bulbs increase quite a bit here. And the bloom is, since they're all in shades of like hot orange, it's actually a great choice for just a big burst of color in the springtime here.
And I like the freesias because not only they have beautiful colors, but they have a wonderful scent.
Yeah, they've been in very short supply for at least 5 years now. So finding freesia bulbs has been hugely challenging, but they're definitely worth getting into this. And again, that's another one that's only hardy pretty much in California. Anyone listening in a colder climate, you're not going to be growing freesias. But in general, bulbs are an adaptation to drought. Most of the bulbs you think of came from places like Asia Minor, which is Turkey, the part of Turkey that's not in Europe. Places like Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan. These are places where it's winter rainfall, dry summer, and the bulb is an adaptation to the dry summer. People tend to think of bulbs as being an adaptation to cold winters, which it certainly is if they are dormant underground and covered with a blanket of snow. But in particular, they're an adaptation to long periods without rainfall. The bulb has the flower all ready to go. It's all, you know, as soon as it gets enough soil moisture and the right temperature, they push out and bloom, often blooming even without leaves on them. So bulbs are a great addition to low water landscapes, and South African bulbs, Mediterranean bulbs in particular, are very well adapted in California for that purpose. So Spiraxis is just one. Daffodils fit fine in low water landscapes. We don't think of them that way because we think of them, you know, from Wordsworth's poems and from pictures in Europe and things like that. And you know, but tulips and daffodils are drought adapted and excellent choices for xeric or low water landscapes.
She also has a lemon verbena. Now, is that the tall plant or is that the short plant?
Yeah, lemon verbena. Mine is now about 6 feet tall. It turns into this lovely, open, informal shrub. I plant lemon verbena near my vegetable garden everywhere. It's all the way back to when I was a teenager, I've done this. Stick it on the edge of the vegetable garden. It grows up to be a shrub about 3 feet the first season, 4 to 5 feet the second season. Those wonderful lemon-scented leaves. The flowers are very attractive to bees and other beneficials. And it just makes this very elegant plant. So think of it as about a 3 to 5 foot shrub. You can let it get bigger. You can prune it back as hard as you want, but it's a great choice for this area.
And you already mentioned rosemary. Yep. Thyme is another one that is makes a little shrub, doesn't it?
Well, the culinary thyme, the kind we use in cooking, is a little one-by-one shrub, the English thyme.
She's talking about
French thyme.
Thyme species and CVS, whatever that means.
Thyme in when people are coming in asking me for it for low water landscapes, they frequently mean the ground cover thyme, which is fine. I just don't want you thinking it's going to be a long lived large scale ground cover, but it's a great thing to have around those stepstones that we talked about going through the garden. Thyme is an excellent thing to have in that situation. It's got a wonderful smell. The flowers are very attractive to bees. It's a very pretty ground cover. I keep going through this thing where people want to replace their lawn. They walk in with a list of plants and the first one on top of it is creeping thyme. And I just say, you know, don't do that. So I'd be happy to sell you 15 flats of thyme or whatever and have you plant them all, but I can tell you what's going to happen. 2 to 3 years in, they'll start dying out. There are other ground covers. Diamondia is a good possibility. You could consider that one. Snow and Summer, the Cerastium tomentosum, I've used that one. Just water carefully and be aware that each ground cover has its advantages and drawbacks.
And then the last one on her chart is Mexican oregano polyomintha longiflora.
I think that one is going to be a little tender here,
It's not here. This is Oregon. Remember, this is Portland, Oregon.
We are?
Isn't that? I'm sorry. My mistake. I'm thinking of the previous thing. This is Santa Clara Valley.
Right. Right. So a little milder than here, but still pretty hot in the summertime. I think that plant may be frost tender. I couldn't find a quick answer to that question. So plant it and fine, but regular oregano, just for the record, is a great garden and landscape plant. Regular culinary oregano. I planted one amongst my lavender and rosemary planting 20 years ago. And that plant has not only spread itself to be about 3 feet across, and it's very pretty in bloom. Bees are all over it and a lot of butterflies go to it. It's also reseeded here and there, filling in around the lavender and the rosemary plant. So oregano can be very ornamental. And even better, there are some ornamental forms of oregano with specific names on them, which are selected for more showy flowers. You may not think of oregano as having showy flowers, but some of them, the flower clusters are actually pink or dense enough to make a very attractive plant. You'll find these out there, Hopley's Hybrid and some of the others. Nurseries still sell them. And so the ornamental oregano can be an excellent choice. So that might prove to be hardier than the one you're choosing, but my guess is that the one on your list would probably be fine. I just think it might be damaged by the cold.
So she sent us a copy of the document from the Santa Clara Valley Water District.
Yep.
And it is the list of qualifying plants. These are plants that you can use in their program. Mm-hmm. And it's 53 pages long.
Good. Huh? Yeah. The usual problem with these is that they're too specific and too short. You should, if you could give people the parameters of low water plants that could go at 30 to 50% of measured evapotranspiration, for example, that would be great, but most people don't have access to that. However, if you're listening, you do actually have access to the overall document that this was probably pulled from, which is the WuCoLS database, WUCOLS, WuCoLS, Water Use Coefficient of Landscape Species is what that stands for. Easy to remember, huh? And it's a massive compendium of plants that have been evaluated by a host of plant professionals for different regions around the state. I recently participated in one of these for our local district, and we went through, I don't even remember how many hundreds of plants. And they all these experts come in, and we give our opinions about the water use characteristics of particular species, and where there's a lot of correlation between what we all say, they just take that. And when there's conflicts between what we say, they bring us together at a Zoom meeting and we hash it out. And that's how this is done. It's an editorial board process, basically. And you can look at that and it will tell you whether this is a plant that can take 30% less water than ET, 50% less water than ET, 70% less water than ET. You got to know what ET is in your region. And the state is divided into water use regions. So if you want to get the information that this Water Agency is working from. WUCOLS data, WUCOLS. Have a lot of fun in there. Then cross-reference that with your Western Garden book and a list of plants that your local garden center has, and you should be good to go. But for these particular projects, the Water District is telling you you must work from this list. And I've seen well-done versions, and I've seen not-so-well-done versions. This is a very well-done version. The list is quite comprehensive and gives you a lot to work with. Now, the comment at the bottom is that they're going to water by hand, which I personally strongly prefer. When I plant things on my farm, I prefer to hand water them at least into the first summer if I possibly can. And that can be a lot of work for me. But what I find with that is that I'm standing there giving the plant, if it's a woody shrub or tree, a few gallons of water all at once. Even if it's just an herbaceous perennial, I'm giving at least a couple gallons of water. I'm washing the leaves off. I'm watering around the basin, a little outside of the basin. And that's really optimal because then you know that new plant is getting not just the nursery soil watered, but the soil that its roots are going to try and grow down into and out into. And people tend not to give enough of the outward growth irrigation. By midsummer, I get kind of sick of that. And so invariably, a new plant that I put in gets onto a drip system by July, if not sooner. And in that case, I use personally a high output emitter or two on each plant. I'm usually using two 2-gallon an hour emitters on a shrub or a tree, sometimes more than that if it's a bigger tree. I'm putting them on the edge of the basin, and I'm watering it long enough that that whole zone gets wet. If you choose to go with the emitterized tubing, the inline emitters, Netafim being the best known brand, but there are others out there, they typically are 0.4 or 0.6 or 0.9 gallon per hour output. So you need to run them for a long time to get the depth of watering that's appropriate. They work fine. And the distribution is great because the emitters are every foot down the line, typically on the most commonly purchased version, but that output is low. And so to get a good soaking, you may need to run it for a couple of hours, 2 to 4 hours all at once, if your soil allows that. And then you should be able, if you're in the Davis Woodland Dixon area, to go almost a full week before you need to do it again. You obviously have to adjust to your soil type and do a little poking around and go out there with that 18-inch screwdriver or the long trowel and dig in after you've watered and see how good a depth you're getting. But if you've got 8 to 10 inches of harvest wood chips on there, you should be able to water really thoroughly once a week. Those wood chips will keep the moisture in the soil. And my guess is that by midsummer, that will be an appropriate watering schedule. Thorough soaking once a week, but you're going to have to play it by ear with your soil. And people listening in areas with sandier soil or any kind of a slope or any kind of raised planter may have to run a couple times a week. That's why I hate to give a rule for, you know, when we've got people listening all over the world, your soil determines how often you water. But in our area, with a good heavy mulch on there, once a week thorough soaking should be adequate. But I do like to hear you doing that hand watering at least for the first couple months.
So usually we end up with a garden quote. And today I want to quote one of my favorite garden experts, Don Shore. And the quote is, check daily, water as needed.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.